This week we will conclude our study of the book of Amos with a consideration of chapters 8 and 9. Herein Amos delivered the end of his curse against the northern kingdom of Israel. It is their final sentence, one of death and destruction, mourning, famine, and exile from which there could be no escape. The northern kingdom had spent generations worshiping idols and not the one true God, and for this God regarded them as being like any other foreign nation, and so he scattered them there. But the prophecy is not without any hope. While the northern kingdom would fall, the house of David, the messianic dynasty of the southern kingdom of Judah, would continue to thrive, and the people of God would look forward to a time of prosperity. In application, we will consider the economic ethics which Amos describes, his prediction of a future messianic kingdom, and the danger for those who think they are part of God's kingdom while refusing to obey his laws. Your passage for consideration then is Amos 8 and 9, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. Chapter 8 opens with God giving Amos a symbolic vision. Such visions, in which God would show the prophet a vision of a physical thing that represents some future reality, would become a recurring feature of prophetic visions. We will find examples of them in Jeremiah, Daniel, and Zechariah, for example. In this vision, God showed Amos a basket of summer fruit. A fruit basket might seem like a pleasant thing, but not this one. This basket, from the end of the harvest, represents the end of the people. There is a pun intended here. The word for summer fruit is kayitz, which sounds like the Hebrew word for end, kitz. So the summer fruit represents the end. The kayitz represents the kitz. God would no more pass by Israel and turn a blind eye. The judgment was at hand. Israel's rulers would suffer the brunt of God's wrath. The palace, and palace is the better translation in verse 3, to be preferred over temple. The palace, which had been filled with songs, would be filled with wailing because the dead bodies of the people of Israel would be strewn about everywhere. This would come about primarily because of the economic abuse of the weak by the powerful. They had trampled on the poor by deceptive business practices. They had used unjust weights and measures, overcharging customers with a larger shekel weight of silver while under-delivering on products with a small ephah, a measure of volume. They would falsely represent the value of their products, mixing the inedible chaff with the wheat, and in doing so they would enrich themselves. Then they would use their profits to exploit their workers, buying up the labor of the poor at the low price of a little silver or a pair of sandals. In such ways, they would selfishly enrich themselves off of the work of others. Oh, and they didn't even wait to take the day off either, not even to honor Jehovah. When the new moon feast would come, they would complain about ending it as soon as possible so that they could get back to selling grain. For a few hundred years, those injustices had been perpetuated on countless victims, many of whom, I suppose, thought that justice would never come. But justice would come. Jehovah had seen the wrongdoing, and he had sworn by himself, the pride of Jacob, the highest of all standards, that he would never forget it. Jehovah would visit his wrath on Israel, and they would tremble. They would be like the Nile River, which in its season would rise to overflow its banks and then fall again. They would experience tumult and tossing, trembling and fear. We read in verse 9 that in the day of Jehovah's wrath, the sun would go down at noon and darken the earth in the day. This at first seems like a metaphor for total disaster, and maybe that's what it is, but it may also be a literal description. Recall that during the reign of Hezekiah, not long after Samaria fell to Assyria, there was an actual event in which the sun apparently moved backward. See our message, Hezekiah's Illness, published March 23, 2025. So this may have been a prophetic prediction of an actual event which marked the conclusion of God's judgment on the northern kingdom. When the end came, the party that Israel's wealthy had been throwing would be over. They had been feasting and singing, but soon they would be mourning and lamenting. They would wear sackcloth and shave their heads in mourning. They would mourn like they had lost their only son, and worse, God would stop speaking to them. For generations, the northern kingdom had ignored the scriptures and ignored the prophets who were sent to them, and not only that, but they had silenced their speech and persecuted them. The northern kingdom had demonstrated that they did not want to hear God, and so in the end, God would stop talking to them. Jehovah declared that there would be a famine in Israel, not of food, but of God's words. These people would be dying of a metaphorical hunger. Their sins would bring disaster and misery on them, and in that misery they would finally humble themselves and seek out God's word to correct the problem. Too bad. They wouldn't find it. there wouldn't be any more prophets to quench their thirst. There wouldn't be any access to a temple to fix their hunger pains. The Levites and their scrolls would be gone far away from them. They would find no relief from their suffering. Their young men and their beautiful virgin girls alike would die of spiritual thirst, and they would all deserve this. The law of Moses had told them that they should swear their oaths in the name of Jehovah, see Deuteronomy 6:13. This divine backing was to be the foundation of Israel's laws. But they didn't want God's laws. They wanted to swear by the gods of Samaria and Dan and Beersheba, idols which they had imagined, and so for this they would fall. Moving into chapter 9, Amos tells us that he saw the Lord, that is Adonai, not the divine name, standing at the altar, apparently intending the fixture in Jehovah's temple in Jerusalem, though perhaps this could intend some pagan temple erected in Israel. And he cried out a command to strike the capitals, the tops of the columns, until the entire building would shake down to its thresholds, shattering the columns and collapsing them onto the people. This signifies a complete religious disaster. The altar was the place for making sacrifices. This is how they could seek forgiveness. But if the temple was destroyed and the altar was buried, the time for penitence had passed. The judgment was final. God would completely withdraw his protection and support. Israel would be killed with the sword, and none of them would escape. There would be no place to hide. They could dig the deepest hole and climb the highest mountain, even up to the sky, and they could go out across the sea or sink to its bottom. Even there, God would send a serpent to bite them. Even if they willingly went into captivity, God would send disasters on them there, killing them with the sword. If they thought they could escape, they were wrong. This is Jehovah we're talking about. This is the one who melts the earth into lava. You think that you won't tremble like the tossing of the Nile? This guy knows. He's the one who made the Nile and makes it toss. He's the one who made the heavens and pours the rain. There's nowhere anyone can go that he isn't in charge. There's nothing he can't do to them while they're there. So not only is the judgment final, it is certain to be performed. For a long time, Israel had enjoyed a special relationship with Jehovah. He had chosen them and brought them out of slavery in Egypt. He had brought them through the wilderness to a good land. The Israelites seemed to believe that this set them apart from the crowd. Surely, however they were behaving, Jehovah would protect them and give them dominance over the region. They were his people, after all. But no, God had given them his covenant. They were his people only in as much as they would keep it. God mocked at their belief that he would keep his end of the covenant when they would not keep theirs. Israel, misbehaving for generations as they had, were no different from the Cushites, Africans, south of Egypt. They were just as any other people on the edge of the map. Sure, he had brought Israel up out of Egypt, but every nation had their origin story, and every nation had at some point been enslaved. The Philistines had come from Kaphtor, a Mediterranean island which had been their origin, and the Arameans had come from Kir beyond the Euphrates. It didn't matter where anyone came from. It mattered how they were living. God was watching the sins of the nations, and whatever nation it was that was sinning, God would destroy. Israel was not special to such an extent that they should prosper in a state of sin. However, Israel was still special in some sense. Jehovah would not utterly destroy them. There would be a remnant that would survive, but he would destroy them generally nonetheless. God was preparing to shake Israel up as in a sieve. A small amount of the good people would sift through, but the sinners would remain. They had supposed that their special relationship would keep them from disaster. They were wrong. The disaster would come. They would die by the sword. But in that day of Jehovah's wrath on the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah would prosper. The house of David, that is the dynasty ruling the southern kingdom from Israel, would rise up. God would repair their breached walls. Indeed, this happened. Ahaz had been king of Judah, and Judah had fallen to a very weak position. But by the time that Israel fell, Ahaz's son Hezekiah had taken the throne and instituted religious reforms. Under his leadership, Judah prospered and maintained their independence. The Assyrians came to destroy Israel, but Judah held them off. The house of David would be strengthened and preserved in preparation for a future time when a descendant of David's line would possess all the surrounding nations. This, of course, is a reference to Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of David, the King of Kings, who will, at the end of days, set up his kingdom to rule over all the earth. In verses 13 through 15, Jehovah declared that there would be a time of full restoration for Israel, the people of God, in which there would be great and lasting prosperity. The abundance would be such that the man plowing the field would overtake the reaper, meaning that the harvest would be so fruitful that it would take so long to pick all of the food that they would still be picking it when it was time to plant again. there would be so many grapes that they would still be treading the grapes from last season when it was time to plant for the new ones. The fortunes of God's people would be restored, and the ruined cities would be rebuilt. Jehovah would replant his people in their land and would never uproot them again. This, of course, is a prophecy of the eternal condition, that believers should be saved to live forever in a new earth, free from death and mourning and crying and pain. See Revelation 21. In application first, let's note that this disaster did happen. Amos was a real prophet. God actually spoke to him, and thus Amos was able to correctly predict the future. The northern kingdom of Israel was indeed at an end. The Assyrians came killing and destroying. They decapitated Israel's leadership. They left dead bodies lying in the palace. There was mourning and bitterness. Israel went into exile to Assyria, where they would no longer hear the word of Jehovah. The evil did not escape, but a small remnant survived among the Jews of Judah. Amos was right. And we recognize again here that a big part of Israel's problem was oppression of the poor. The primary focus of God's wrath was visited on the elites. The dead bodies were strewn about the palace. The curse fell on those who trampled the needy and on those who had been feasting and singing. Well, there was a lower economic class of people in Israel who were not feasting and singing. They were toiling and struggling to make ends meet. The descriptions we get of how they trampled the needy are in verses 5 and 6. First, they were being pressed not to take breaks. The investor class wanted them selling on the Sabbath and the new moon. The law of Moses prescribed certain holidays when people were not to be required to work. Every seventh day, they got a day off, and there were other holidays to boot. People are not machines who ought to be expected to work nonstop, round the clock, 365 days per year. We need rest. Good employers give their employees breaks, days off, limited working hours, holidays, and vacation time. Employers should remember that maximizing profit by keeping their employees moving at all times is not the primary goal of life. The glorification of God is the goal of life, and one of the ways that we glorify God is by enjoying the time He has given us. There is a time for work, but there must also be a time for rest and for enjoyment. To fail to give workers this is a moral wrong. Second, they are taking advantage of the poor by offering them low wages. Verse 6 describes it as buying the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. Now I understand how supply and demand works. There are laborers, and laborers earn their wages. Where there is a surplus of laborers in the market, demand for those laborers decreases, and so wages decrease. But when there are too many workers available, that can mean a race to the bottom, where whomever is willing to accept the least for his work is the one who gets the job, and someone is always willing to accept less than a livable wage. By offering a low wage, the investors running the business can make maximum profits without working while keeping their workers just scraping by. This is unethical. The working class ought not to be treated like slaves, and the passive income class ought not to get rich off of their labors. Employers should resist the temptation to take advantage of their workers by offering them a wage that suits the market, but which is too low to live on. On that note, my Bible says that women are supposed to work in the home. See Titus 2, 4 through 5. Unfortunately, most people ignore that command today. They send the wives out to earn a second income. And as a result, we have a market that is flooded with laborers. More laborers drive wages down. This drives more people to send their wives to work because they need a second income to keep up, further exacerbating the problem. So people thought that they would get ahead by sending women to work, but in the end, all they did was tear down the home and create a society where no one can keep up. Unfortunately, that problem isn't going to be fixed until Christians start refusing to send their wives to work, and Christian employers must start disobeying unjust United States employment laws that require them to hire women. Employers also should not be taking advantage of potential employees who are financially disadvantaged. For example, asking on a job application how much an employee made at his last job takes advantage. That question has nothing to do with how much is a fair wage for the work, and it ensures that people who were desperate for money in the past stay chained down to earning less than their full potential, because each successive employer offers them less than what they might have offered, knowing that the desperate person is willing to accept a low wage. That is an unethical hiring practice. And also, it is very unfortunate that employers faced with actually paying workers what they are worth will often send jobs overseas to pay pennies on the dollar for workers who are effectively slave laborers. That is an unethical practice. Generally, workers should not be treated like a commodity. They are people, made in the image of God. Every worker should earn a wage that is sufficient for him to pay his bills and support his family without him having to rely on his wife to pay his bills for him. Now, I must say I'm no fan of government intervention into the free market. I'm not advocating for price fixing or excessive minimum wages that kill jobs, but I am telling Christians that they have a certain obligation in the market that they should fulfill. Another unethical business practice is the use of unjust weights and measures. The scriptures condemn this in many places. Proverbs 11:1 says, "A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight." Leviticus 19:35 says, "You shall do no wrong in judgment, in measures of length or weight or quantity." Deuteronomy 25:14 says, "You shall not have in your house two kinds of measures, a large and a small." But Israel was doing this. They would offer a thing for sale, say an ephah of grain for a certain weight of silver. But then they would cheat the customer by providing an amount smaller than an ephah and tipping the scale with a false weight to get their customers to pay more in silver. And the same thing is done today in many ways. Inflating the currency is the most obvious. There was a time when a dollar was 1 ounce of silver. That's what dollar meant. A paper dollar was a silver certificate that could be exchanged for an ounce of silver. That's a just measure. But modern economists think they know better. The dollar is no longer tied to the metal, and the government is always printing more paper dollars to pay its bills with a target of inflating the currency, that is, lowering the value of the currency relative to the metal it once represented. As I write, an ounce of silver sells for more than 30 paper dollars. This is monkeying with the weights as a means of stealing from the people, and many who have saved their wealth in cash have lost a fortune by it. And of course, there are other such ways of doing this. Making a bait and switch, in which you offer something and then provide something else, or overcharging someone, or stacking up hidden fees to charge more than advertised. Such practices are unethical. And the Israelites were also intentionally offering inferior products. They were mixing the chaff with the wheat. So if you're going to be in business, you have a duty to do your best to offer your best products that are of a high quality, safe, and as advertised, not junk. Next, we move out of the realm of ethics and into the realm of messianic prophecy. Today's passage in chapter 9, 11 through 15, tells us a prediction that is yet future. Amos predicted that the line of David would rise up to lead all the nations called by Jehovah's name. This has not yet happened in history. The rule of the Davidic dynasty over Judah would continue for only a few hundred more years, and they would not be at all a rule over all the nations, nor a time of great prosperity. This prophecy has not yet been fulfilled, but it awaits a future fulfillment. We know now that the prophecy will find its fulfillment in Jesus Christ. Jesus is the anointed Messiah of David's line. He is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and he will return to set up an eternal kingdom. That time has not yet come, but the time will come when the people of God will be planted, never again to be uprooted. Amos chapter 9, verses 13 through 14 describes an unending time of superabundant prosperity, a time of lacking nothing. And so we look forward to that time at Jesus' second coming. And finally, we must yet again talk about living on cheap grace. Ancient Israel reminds me so much of modern pop Christianity. The Israelites were saying, "Oh yeah, we're Jehovah's people. He brought us up out of Egypt, you know?" But Jehovah had other thoughts. He did not recognize these as his people because they would not obey him. He had given them moral laws, but they ignored these and turned to selfishly serving their own interests at the expense of the rights of their brothers. They thought that they were a special people set apart, but for their many sins, they looked no different than the Philistines or the Arameans or the Cushites. They had no special favor from God. In fact, for their persistent misconduct, Jehovah was prepared to destroy them. How many churches are like this today? You've got a bunch of people who show up and say, "Oh, we're saved because we prayed the sinner's prayer one time when we were five," yeah? But then there's no evidence that those people ever truly repented of their sins. There's no evidence of God working in their lives. They just persist in any sin with no restraint. They do basically anything that they want with no regard for God's laws and no regard for the rights of others. Are those people Christians? What does God think? Unfortunately, there are too many today who have cheapened the blood of Christ. They go on sinning like it means nothing. They expect to be saved for no good reason, and then they give nothing back. That isn't the kind of salvation that Jesus taught. Jesus asked in Luke 6:46, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I tell you?" In Matthew 7:21, he said, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. As for those who would not, he says in verse 23, and then will I declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. It is true that you can do nothing to earn God's grace. It is a free gift. But if you have it, then once you have it, you will do something with it. Jesus didn't come to save us so that we could live a life of lawlessness. He didn't free us from laws so that we could be saved to do whatever we want. He came to free us from the power of sin so that we could have the power to live the way that he wants us to live. So live the right way. Don't go on ignoring the moral laws of the scriptures and violating the rights of your brothers and supposing that you're one of God's people because your daddy brought you to church when you were five. That won't do it. To conclude, in the book of Amos, the prophet condemns the northern kingdom of Israel for their continual sins, emphasizing particularly the abuse that the wealthy and powerful imposed on the weak and the poor. In chapters 8 and 9, the closing chapters of the book, he proclaimed the finality of this inescapable punishment. Exile would come at the hands of the Assyrians, and it would come no more than 65 years later. In examining Amos's concluding remarks, we considered the economic sins of the northern kingdom, how they abused their workers and cheated their customers. Ideally, we will show better business ethics than they had. We also considered the final coming of Christ's kingdom and contemplated our duty to obey the laws of God if we are part of it. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.